No, as long as we keep trying, we know we're better. That's all that matters. Sure, it's easier to be the bad guy and not give a damn, but it's not what we are, not anymore. I'm Chris Spivey.
And I'm Eddie Webb.
And today, we talk about dark matter on Genreless. Hey, everybody. So today we're going to talk about dark matter, which I long pause for dramatic license.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was waiting for you.
So, we're still figuring it out as we go through. Right.
Dark matter. It was a show I had no context for when you first recommended it. I mean, well, I take it back. I do need to make a controversial statement. The only context I got for Dark Matter before you recommended it was it's like Firefly, and therefore I hated it because I liked Firefly when it first broadcast. I have grown to hate it because so many people have talked so much about it afterwards. And so it's like, oh, like Firefly. It's like, well, I'm not going to watch that show then. So when you first recommended it, I was like, okay, we'll see. But I really did dig it.
So we should probably also mention how we came up with all the shows. It's like we both sort of compiled a list of different shows and just had this massive ongoing document. And each of us kind of went through and said, no, not that one, not that one, not that one. Are you sure you can talk about that for more than 5 minutes?
Right.
And so Firefly was on the list, but it is not aged well. And there is a lot of other things associated with the creator that I personally don't want to talk about.
Right.
Because I don't. And on this podcast, it's supposed to be fun about the love of shows, about the love of the creators kind of making these things and about how they're trying to change and make things better. Mm-hmm. And that's not a conversation I felt that we could have had about that show and that creator.
Right. Yep. Completely agree. And so when I first saw it, I was like, well, because I know we talked about that. It's like, you know, Firefly. And I saw it as like, let's talk about this instead. And I'm like, okay, cool. Well, I trust you. Let's give it a shot. And I mentioned this before air, but we generally, you know, shoot for like watching 3 to 4 episodes. And I had a trip coming. And so usually I download episodes before the trip. And so I had downloaded a different show before this. So here's the 4 episodes I'm going to watch. I got on the plane, watched 3 to 4 episodes, got to the hotel, and immediately downloaded the rest of season 1. I am hooked. I am into this. So I'm definitely on the dark matter train, as it were. But I also came to this pretty much completely blind.
So one of the big things about the show, though, is originally it started, I think, as a comic book run. And the first 2 episodes are heavily based on the comic.
Oh, okay.
The comic itself was built to be almost a pitch piece for a TV series or movie.
Well, it worked.
And then it got some of the crew from Stargate to come and sort of like infuse their addictive watchability of their shows. Because if anyone watches Stargate, you know, Stargate has this thing where it sort of builds on itself and you get sucked into it and you want to find out what happens to the cast next week.
Oh, no, because Stargate's also a show I have not watched. Oh, no.
We could have an entire show just dedicated to Stargate to go through it episode by episode, given 70% of those episodes will probably be fluff, but they'd be fun fluff. And the other 30% are more plot focused.
But also it has like, what, like 97 seasons? It's long.
If we wanted to do SG-1, if we wanted to do like any of the expansion series, much like Babylon 5, if we wanted to, we could go back and do Crusade.
True.
I'd be a happy talk, though.
I don't remember much of Crusade. I don't remember liking it. I just don't remember much of it, though. It kind of just a blank spot. But anyway.
Really, it's just me and 2 of the people that remember it, so you're fine.
You were there. Yes. So, yeah, Dark Matter.
So, we'll talk about Dark Matter than the array of other shows. Before we even get into it, what was it that caught your attention so much and made you want to like go and download all of first season?
It honestly comes to the first 2 episodes, which is a natural kind of place to start talking. when I first start watching it, it's like they have amnesia, and I'm like, oh God, the amnesia plot, right? Like the start of every JRPG ever. The characters have amnesia and they don't know what to are. And we'll learn about them as they learn about themselves. And I was like, I've seen this so many times. But I think what helped me was that it was pretty clear that these were characters who were on the page written to not get along. Like the gimmick is pretty clear. They're going to learn things about themselves that are actually pretty awful. And they're going to the allegiances and the relationships are going to be constantly reexamined as they get new information. Which, even if I'm familiar with that structure, it's still a really good structure. There's a reason why it keeps showing up because it really does work. And honestly, the only way that works is if the actors nail that chemistry immediately. And boy, howdy they did. Like within 15 minutes, I was like, I want to watch these people on screen do stuff, which is important. And so it also helps that like all of them are visually distinctive and their personality is distinctive. And they lean on a good use of archetype storytelling. Because like there's different archetypes and stereotypes. Stereotypes are when there's nothing but the archetype. You know, that's all that's there. This is a show that's okay. You have the badass captain. You have the sleazy guy who's not for himself. You have the quiet warrior. You know, you have the spunky kid genius. These are all well known archetypes, but pretty quickly you're shown that there are layers to them, and so it's okay. There's gonna be more coming, and that does pay off. Like within later episodes, even the ones you jump ahead, it's like, okay, these characters clearly have grown and evolved and gotten depth over time. So that's a good way of doing it. They didn't stay in that lane. They slowly grow and evolve and change, which is nice.
And it also didn't hurt that special effects at the time were great for what they were doing, especially for a space show. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times space shows don't get the same budget other shows do. And the budget they got, they applied very well throughout the run of the show.
Right. Like, I mean, it was pretty clear this was the lower budget show in the sense of there's a lot of episodes that take place on the spaceship set. They build a set. They're going to put a lot of stuff on the set, so you have to build additional sets. That kind of writing was pretty clear. And there was one of the episodes later on where it's like, okay, it was filmed like pretty obviously in like a power plant. I find that charming. Like I enjoy that. I mean, as someone who loves Doctor Who, like, okay, kind of spotting the set is part of the fun for me, but you're
right. Let's just go all out to the quarry and shoot our show.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, you know, here's this week's Gray Rocks, you know, it's like, that's okay. I'm into that. But you're right. The actual, both the practical effects and the, digital effects are actually really, really good. They spent their money wisely. And it's clear that even as a limited show, they spent it wisely. They're very strategic about it. And again, if you have a bunch of people that are crammed into a ship, those people have to be watchable, and they really are.
And for me, one of the things that originally hooked me on watching it was the cast itself. Mm-hmm. Because I like sci-fi shows just in general. That's sort of my genre of choice. I admitted it on genres. And when you look at the cast photo, you see there's like all these people from different potential backgrounds, different stories, almost like different economic statuses too, when you just take a glance at the cast. Mm-hmm. And that pulls me in because I've seen so many shows just have primarily a white cast of characters with like maybe one marginalized person from some background. And then that's their show and that's what they run with. And getting a chance to see all these different people from different backgrounds do just the work, like do the job. And it's not mentioned or referenced because that's not important in the 27th century. Like us as a crew, getting our next thing is what matters.
Right. And that was one thing I actually also liked is the first 5 minutes. We're going to talk about the episode, obviously, but this is not a spoiler. But the first 5 minutes, zoom in on a white guy who wakes up and he looks like he's moving around the ship, like he's in charge. Then woman wakes up, comes in, beats the crap out of him, just obliterates him. And then she's in charge pretty much from that point forward. And there's the occasional why are you in charge thing, but really no one really questions why Two is in charge. She's just in charge. And I dig that, right? It's the sense of there's very clear reasons why each of the characters gravitate to the roles they have. And gender and race are neither of those factors.
Because one of the parts, just to, sorry to touch on okay. that, was that when someone actively says who put you in charge, two says no one else did it. And that stopped the entire conversation because right. none of them wanted to do it.
Right. Because she's like, I stepped up. Nobody else did. Done. And it's like, well, yeah, you did. I do want to kind of actually, because also like segues into the second episode. But one thing that I'm not sure how I feel about it is Four and Four's background.
Oh, yeah, that's
because we reveal that he's a prince, and they did that really well. It's like, you know, very first episode, he finds a strange box, and then Five also finds the box later and messes with it, opens it, and so Four is able to actually find inside the box is a signet ring, and it turns out that the signet ring, he's royalty. It's a cool story, but also his home world is so obviously samurai Japan.
Yeah,
and he's and
his weapon of choice.
Is a sword. And so I'm like, I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, I like the fact that a lot of the main characters in that dynasty, from what little I've seen, are actors of color, because that's an unfortunate common thing where it's like, oh, it's the future, so white people can play all these prominent roles, right? So I mean, I like that part at least. And also the fact that they could have easily had accents and they didn't. So I mean, like, I feel like there were good decisions made along the way, but I think the core decision makes me feel like a little, I'm not sure how I should feel about that.
I'm in the exact same boat. And since we're talking about the show, we can do spoilers. Okay. We already know they're all bad people, but since Four potentially them becomes a villain, but not a villain, mm-hmm. and none of the rest of them sort of go to that same extreme. Mm-hmm. That sort of dovetails into what you're talking about, which has more uncertainty about. I know how I feel about seeing that as being portrayed.
Yeah, it feels very yellow peril-y to me, honestly. But that's actually another reason why I wanted to also watch it is because when you jump to the end of season two, and you said Four is very clearly narratively positioned to be the villain, even though there is a scene which sets up that maybe he's not. So I was like, I want to see how we got there, right? I want to see, like, how did we get to this point where these decisions are being made? I have enough trust that there's at least good intent made along the way. But that was like really the only real sour note, especially because everything else is a corporation from what I saw. All of the power players are corporations, except there's one planet where it happens to be royalty and it just happens to be coded a very specific way. It's like, okay.
And so part of me almost thinks now, as we're talking about it, that seeing how Four is portrayed, I'm trying to remember the game now from the 90s. It was the one that was Planescape.
Right.
And your character kept dying over and over and you kept coming back. Mm. So spoiler for a 20, 30-year-old game.
Right.
It turns out the bad guy is just a version of you. And the version of you isn't evil, but it's considered the pragmatic one that makes the appropriate choices, regardless of whether they're considered just or not. Mm-hmm. And Four's character, thinking about it throughout the show, seems to have had a similar developmental track that goes through. Because it's usually about like his planet, his people, once he uncovers that, and then the choices that leads him to make.
Right. And I mean, again, normally I'd be a little harder on this, but given the tenor of the show, like the quote you read is that the spine of the show is these were people who were bad people, their memories were wiped, they were given a new chance, and they all choose to try to do better. And so naturally, as they uncover their pasts, they're going to be start drawn towards the gravity of the things they did before. And so a lot of what's interesting on the screen is watching them struggle with that, because it is easier to go. And sometimes they slip. It's not in the episodes we cover, but so I'll be vague about it. But Six has a really interesting arc in season one where he discovers something that he was involved in was bad. And he leans into that and kind of, you know, it's very brutal at one point. And it's a really interesting story. So if this archetype is you are the prince who is in a corrupt family and everyone's kind of a jerk, And you want to try to do better, you're going to have to make hard decisions to survive inside that society, which means from the outside, you may look like you've become the thing that you've been trying to struggle against. So that, again, can be an interesting story. So this is one of the times where our format kind of struggles against us, because I saw those slices and like, okay, I've got to know what happened in those other 24 episodes to get us to here, because boy, I have questions. So
a lot of me now is curious about the actual writer's room that was also associated with the show. It's something that I hadn't looked at before, and I'm really curious about how the makeup of the room went, how the stories were pitched. The same thing for most shows, because that informs so much of what we're watching as viewers, because the actors can take it and put their spin on it and try to change good things to bad and so forth and so on. But that initial kernel of the thing is what I'm really curious about now.
Right. And one thing that I was also thinking about is the fact that this show is produced in Canada, and Canada has a different relationship with race than America does. So, I mean, some of it may just been unintentional, or they may have had a more diverse room. I mean, there may be lots of factors that could change how that worked out. But some of it is also the fact that as Canadians, they may be like, oh, well, this isn't a big deal. I know digression, but the Kim's Convenience writing room struggled with this at times, because it's like, oh, well, Canada, of course, we're very inclusive and respectful of stuff. But then there's these subtle spots they don't catch. And the actors have to kind of step in and be like, and fill in some of those gaps for them at various points. I bring it up. That's a relatively minor point. And I feel like, at least in the episodes I saw, Four is clearly so much more of a character than just that. So, I mean, it helps that he's an interesting character outside of this structure. So he's not, he's an archetype who is transcending the archetype. It's just that the stereotype trappings around him sometimes, I think, drag him back a little bit.
I guess we could also technically say that about Five, who has some of that projected Manny Pixie aspects of the character.
That's true. And there's also a sense of Hollywoodized urban youth, I guess I would phrase it. we're bouncing around in reference to it, but Ace from Doctor Who is a sense of that's not how teenagers in these subcultures actually act. That's how television perceptions of teenagers in these subcultures act. It's like, on the one hand, I get that. It's TV shorthand for this is the archetype we're going for. I have not watched enough to get a sense of why Five is where she's at, but I have watched enough to know that Five is kind of the heart of the crew, and I'm not entirely sure how she... But there's obviously conflicts inside of her about it, right? She's not a perfect. I make everyone happy when I mean there's clearly some. She has her own conflicts and frustrations and angers, which I like. I'm glad to see that, because so many times the manic pixie vibe is just I'm going to be spunky and everyone's going to love me and that will pull everyone together. So there's more depth to her than just that from what little I've seen so far. But I agree with you that like sometimes when you're watching these things in snippets, it can feel like that's just the role she plays.
But that's also one of the reasons why I wanted to do the show like this, is so that we could touch on all those different aspects. And if people get hooked on the show, then they can go back and watch it for themselves and see how those archetypes potentially change throughout the course of a show based on the writing and the acting choices, or unfortunately sometimes how they don't change or they get worse. But then that gives like perspective of what you can look for in other shows and helps me figure out what I gear towards I want to watch and I want to put like my money in.
Right. And I think it helps also that having the third season episode in there actually helped, because it's clear when you get to Isn't That a Paradox, that there's much more comfort there, right? Like, these are characters that have relationships with each other. They work together. They still rub against each other in interesting ways, but it's not always like damaging. There's just a confidence in how they portray those characters that's very, very prevalent and very obvious. Even while the show does seem like it's stepping through all of the tropes, it's like, now we're doing it. here's the heist episode. Now we're doing a time travel episode. Just like, okay, I get it. You have to do these.
Here's our alternate dimension episode, which is only touched on
yes.
in the three that we watched.
Yeah, it's mentioned.
I don't know if you caught it.
Yeah, I saw in the recaps. It was like, you know, when we went to that parallel dimension, we saw this horrible thing happens. Now we have to come prevent that. And I'm like, okay, it's Dark Phoenix. Got it. All right, cool. All right. So, I mean, it's, but again, I don't mind that because if the goal of the show, this goes to plot driven versus character driven, right? Like if it's a plot driven show and you're doing recycled plots, the show gets really boring. If it's character driven, if you're using recycled plots, that's fine because because you get to see how the characters deal with the situations, and sometimes you find interesting stuff. And I think Isn't It a Paradox is a good exploration of that because you get to see these characters in our modern world and how that works and doesn't. And of course, it's the funny fish out of water story. Again, this is not an uncommon trope. But then there's some surprising drama in the middle of that. And again, you get the last act twist of, oh, the kids you were talking to turns out to be important to history. I mean, yeah, it's yes, I've watched Voyager too. Thank you. I know how that works. But it was fun to see Five be a goth kid and try to figure things out. You know, it was fun to watch the android be a suburban mom. And actually, I'll talk about the android for a second.
We haven't mentioned the android at all, have we?
Yeah, I really want to talk about the android because, first of all, there is a Star Trek joke that I don't know if it's intentional or not, but I think it might be. Where, so the crew is, they wake up in order, and they take the names of the order they wake up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Then the android wakes up. They wake up a female blonde android who's super strong. They never give her a number, but she would be 7 if she did have a number. And Star Trek Voyager has a strong blonde Borg named 7 of 9. And I saw that. I was like, that's, I feel like it's not a joke. It's so close to it. But to a larger point, when I started watching it, I was like, okay, it's emotional Android, blah, blah, blah. And then I saw that performance hadn't really changed over seasons. And I was like, this is really coded as autistic to me. And so I actually looked online about it, and it turns out a lot of autistic fans really gravitated to the android as a result of that. They saw themselves in that character in a very real way. And I was glad to see that because, especially in Isn't That a Paradox, you see that, I think, a little more clearly because you're in a modern setting. The way that she fixates on very specific topics of interest, the way she clearly struggles with social interactions. I was like, I could see why some autistic viewers would really say, like, oh yeah, that's me. I have those problems. So I was like, oh. And then the writers apparently were like, that wasn't intended, but once it was pointed out to us, we did get some consultants on board and we did try to do better about that. So that's one area.
That's great to hear.
Yeah, I definitely saw they were doing good with that. And I'm glad to see that was done well. And apparently the actress really loved that role and tried very hard to make sure that was done well too. So that was a surprising amount of love for a character. It doesn't even have a name. Never gets a name, as far as I know.
No, and the other thing is you encounter other androids, and other androids actually have names.
Yeah.
And there's at least one scene where android engages with another android and calls that android by their name. And mm-hmm. they respond back, Android.
Yeah. So their name is Android, I guess, at this point.
So I we should probably touch on this. So I think one of the reasons, at least this episode may feel a little bit different than the other episodes and not as like focused on per particular episode, is that it is, as you were talking about earlier, a more character-driven show. And it's less about each week's individual plot as compared to what the characters are doing to move that plot along. Well, mm-hmm. Babylon 5 was definitely a structured plot show first, then characters who are also great second.
And a good example of that is it's actually episodes we didn't touch on, but there's an episode where they have to do a heist and the heist goes wrong and the team they're working with turns on them, which there's a very similar episode in Firefly. Just touch on it, and they wrap up in one episode, right? It's like they do the job, they get betrayed, they resolve the treasure, because that's plot driven. That's the plot. Because this is character driven, the betrayal happens And that's the cliffhanger. And then the whole next episode is just them resolving the betrayal. And so it's because it gives space for the characters to, how do they react to this? How do they react to these situations? They learn something surprising about themselves as a result of that. Certain subplots that have been going on for the character levels move ahead a couple spaces in that show. And that's one thing I even in bits and pieces, the reason I went back to watch is because even in these little clips I was seeing, there's always little bits of character movement each time. And it's always done not to the side of the plot, but the plot is motivating those movements. And that's always really interesting to me. And so occasionally, the way, if this is a plot-driven show, you would want to have this resolved by the end of the episode because you want to see how the plot resolves. But that's not what the show's about. And so it will comfortably go to two episodes or three episodes or kind of wrap it up halfway through the next episode while the next thing is starting. It's much more like an old school comic book in that respect, where they just always like other things ending and other things starting. And there's kind of a, I'm guessing a harder cut. Actually, no, it's not a harder cut at the end of the season. It's because We Save the Galaxy is a season cliffhanger and didn't really resolve. There's still dangling threads at the end of that episode. So it just feels very, it's an overused word, but it feels very organic.
Agreed. That's one of the reasons why I'm glad we chose the episode, chose this series. Because it tells stories, but it's telling stories in a slightly different way than the other shows that we've watched so far. And to have something focused just on characters more than anything else was, at the time, even like 2015, 2017 when I watched it, refreshing, but also frustrating as someone that likes plot, as someone who wants to like put like this overarching thing first, regardless of scale.
Right.
And for like Babylon 5, it was like, saving the entire galaxy. For this, I was hoping it's like some sort of per episode or like smaller sci-fi arcs and to get that plot hook and like end it. But instead, it was a constant ongoing thing. And that was engaging and a little bit addictive to watch. And the other crew that you mentioned, their tech guy, I love their tech guy who helps the crew but hurts the crew at the same time. Mm-hmm. And like that relationship and that character was beautiful to see.
Right, yeah. And the other thing that was interesting to me is there's naturally going to be romantic relationships. And given the dynamic of the crew, there's only one woman that the men can naturally have a relationship with. So again, that was an area where I was worried it was going to get kind of awkward. But two is pretty open about her sexuality. She's like, you know, she's very free with her sexuality. She's also has very clear boundaries. And it was just really surprisingly sex positive for a show like this. And because it's character driven, following that is interesting. It doesn't feel puerile. It doesn't feel like, oh, we get to see them have sex. It's like, no, there's character reasons behind it because you actually don't see anything. Like a person taking your shirt off kind of is all you really see any time so far. And there's another part where they find a second android who's played by Ruby Rose. And I was like, is that Ruby Rose? It's got to be Ruby Rose.
I was going to mention one and one's interaction, but it looks like you got it.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, they, one is sexually frustrated, and so like it's clear they unpacked the attractive woman, and everyone in the crew is like, okay, we know why you're unpacking this robot, and they keep dancing around, like, she's a good cook and she's very entertaining. And then when the android finally is like, Wendy's her name, she's been like, do you want to have sex? And it's super awkward for like 5 minutes as he's like, no, I really don't, blah blah blah. And it's not done because this hot person who identifies as female is going to be having sex with this man and whatnot. It's, you learn a lot about one and you learn a lot about some of the other crew. And you also, it's a really good look into when you have a small crew like this, everyone's in everyone's business, whether they want to be or not. Because Four does not care about any of his stuff and still gets dragged in and it bothers him. and that's, again, something else that I actually liked about Four, because at first I was like, oh, it's the quiet Asian stereotype. But they actually do play that well because he genuinely does not give a shit on a very real level, and still he ends up caring and still gets involved and ends up considering these people family at one point. So again, it's a good use of that archetype. But I can see your point where like there's certainly one point where early on we found a thing. Five finds a thing, and that thing does not pay off for like 7 episodes. It's like, we found a thing, and then like, because I was watching these episodes, it's like, you know, they mentioned the blink drive. It's okay, it's the blink drive. But so I went back to watch through, and I'm like, okay, so obviously it's an episode 2 that they'll find this weird drive. No, it takes a long time before they go, oh, we have this drive now. So yeah, some of the plot stuff just hangs there.
We're giving spoilers and we're a little bit more all over the place today, because that's how we have to talk about the show. But So the blink drive is this advanced piece of technology that basically allows a starship to teleport anywhere in the galaxy. So you can teleport under a planet's shields, mm-hmm. and everyone wants it.
Right.
Oh, that's it.
The only reason I even brought up is because it is the plot point for But First We Save the Galaxy. That is why we've hired your people.
And the other joy of that, if we're going to talk a little bit more about how they sort of grow into like a very weird family unit that hates and loves each other at once, mm-hmm. even when they establish for a while 4 as villain antagonists and they're going to blow up the space station, 4 comes in, steals the blink drive from them so he can go about his own plots, but then actively tells the android to notify the rest of the crew to come onto the ship so they don't die on the explosion.
Mm-hmm.
Like those sorts of things. And later on, which when they capture 4 again, they don't kill 4. They're stuck in this weird sort of moral complexity place. Like, he's one of us, but he's not one of us. Like, how do we do this? But yet they still help him when he needs help.
Right. And similarly, although I have not gotten this far in my own watching, but given that 1 is very prominent in season 1 and disappears from the show, I think I have an idea who the traitor is. So I suspect a similar things of like, this person was part of a family and now we have to deal with this new situation where there are antagonists. And there are minor moments of that. Like, 3 is a pretty common per episode internal antagonist. He's the guy who says the things that space pirates should be saying that nobody really wants to hear, but also occasionally has a valid point. But I mean, you're right. There's always a kind of tension there, and how they resolve that is interesting. And I think it's really maybe a good way to tell you why I gravitated to this is because I dig stories of
family. Can I pause 1 more second?
Yeah, sure.
And even before that, to like give another example, for instance, like 6 kind of betrays everyone at one point.
Yes.
And if you've seen it, they talk about it briefly and they're all arrested because of 6. And then they have this thing of like, we're going to kill you because you put us all back in jail. And yet, you know, by the next episode somewhere along the way, 6 is back in the crew and back in their good graces. Like that sort of constantly shifting dynamics of the relationships.
Yeah. And I think it's maybe a better way of why I gravitated this is because it's that found family. As someone who was disowned by part of his family, I've always kind of enjoyed found family just as on a personal level, because I believe very strongly in that. I believe very strongly in the idea that there are people that you can think of as family who aren't biologically related to you. And so seeing something that on the screen is always interesting to me, because any family fights, and it just happens that their fights usually involve a lot more gunfire or swordplay than most other families. So, I mean, I keep going back to this, but I mean, it's definitely a show where, unlike DS9, unlike Babylon 5, where character development is interesting and compelling, but it is at the service of the plot. This is definitely a show where the plot is at the service of the character development. You only see things because they are interesting for the characters. And so therefore you get relatively functional rudimentary plots, but then become interesting because what do these characters do with this sci-fi trope?
And it's nice to see someone who is your first inclination for most of them is to do the bad thing, and to watch that struggle against doing the bad thing, to do the good thing and be bad at doing the good thing.
Yes.
To then still keep trying to do the good thing because you don't want to be the person that you were before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To avoid going back to Firefly, I'm actually going to pivot and say, compared to something like, say, Guardians of the Galaxy. Because Guardians of the Galaxy, again, very similar archetype, sci-fi crew of misfits trying to get along, and they discover they're basically a family. And even some of the archetypes are kind of there, although in a less pleasing way, because the mediocre white dude is in fact in charge of the ship. But I mean, there's still, you know, the weird spunky sidekick who's a technical genius and so on. But I mean, I think one thing that the movies can't do is, because there's not enough time, is to dig into those relationships more. So it still has to be pretty plot driven. And you see just glimpses of what that can be. And so it's like you kind of get a sketch of a romantic arc, or you get a sketch of Rocket trying to be a good person. And because of the time limit, they never really have the time to do something genuinely bad. And what I saw in Dark Matter so far is these characters make genuinely awful decisions. They think they are the right decision at the time, but they do flat out murder people. They do flat out betray their comrades at times. They think there's a plan, but there's a miscommunication, and the miscommunication is not always plot driven. The miscommunication stems from the relationships. So it's interesting, because there is the room to say, okay, I know on an intellectual level that the characters will get out of this, because that's the premise of the show, but it's not going to happen in 45 minutes. It might not happen in a season. And that's adds some interesting reason to keep watching, because it's the, go back to Four. It's like, you know, we know the Force probably not evil, but the fact that we're at the end of season two and he's still in that place, it's like, okay, so when does he stop not being evil? does he ever come back to the crew? You know, or is this just what we do now? You know, you don't know. And so, like something you said, when Six betrays the crew, it's like, you know that at some point in time is coming back, like you said, but you don't know when, and you don't know how that's going to happen. So there's still drama there.
We'll play the captain's game, but I have a new game that,
okay.
Sorry, folks. Eddie isn't aware of this, because I just thought of it myself like 2 minutes ago.
Oh no.
So we're just focusing on the Six and not the android, but the six members of the crew, if you had to give each of them, we'll say like one potential like aspect or word that sort of solidifies who they are. I think originally you said, for instance, Five was the heart for you.
Right. Yep.
What would it be for all six?
So one, I think, starts off as the heart. But I don't know where his arc's going, but it's clearly he evolves into something else that evolves him out of the show.
Just on what you viewed so far. Like, okay, just on the episodes that our fans, all five of you, have viewed so far.
Fair enough. That he is probably the conscience at this point. Two is definitely the captain. Just even though I don't think she ever gets the title, she's the captain, period. And she will be the person I consider for the captain's game. Three is the realist. Maybe even pessimist, but clearly he believes his role to be the person who has to confront the hard realities and make sure the other people on the team recognize the hard realities. He just is an asshole about it because he's three. Four's kind of nebulous for me because he's the muscle, really. I mean, if you look at it from almost like a leverage perspective, even though a lot of people are very capable fighters, he's so steadily put into combat roles. Security might be another way of phrasing that, both in the Star Trek sense of security, but also he is a person they rely on to keep them safe. Six, I think, is if one is the person who sees himself as a conscience, I think Six is the genuine conscience of the crew. Because what I've seen of Six is that he is conscience leavened with reality in a way. He's frankly the most stable of the entire crew, from what I've seen. Because everyone else goes to an extreme. Like two is very much, you know, heavy hangs the head, and one is like, I'm gonna save everybody, and three is like, I'm gonna murder everyone, take their money. But six is like, okay, there is a middle ground. Sometimes we have to make hard decisions, sometimes we have to do things we don't like, but I will always do the right thing. And I will always do the right thing, even if you don't like me doing the right thing. But I need to do the right thing. His relationship with Five, I love. Because he both wants to give her autonomy, but also recognizes he's a child and cares about her. And so they're both constantly adjusting between the am I a father figure or am I your friend's dynamic. And I think it stems from Six wanting to be this person who genuinely wants to do the right thing, but he's like, you are a woman on the cusp of adulthood, and so you're in that awkward space where I'm not sure if I should treat you as an adult or as a child. And that really comes through in Five's relationship with Six. That does not really come through, because the rest of the crew either just demeans her as the kid or gives her autonomy. Like, two treats her as a peer, three does not. Six is constantly shifting that space. And I really love that relationship, frankly. It goes back to, weirdly, it goes back to our discussion last week about positive Black father figures. I think Six is kind of a father figure for Five in a lot of ways. And then the similar role, he's trying to be a positive paternal figure.
So I kind of like, just, I'd like the actor Roger Cross. I've also seen him in a few other Canadian sci-fi shows. And he's always sort of has that constant, steady presence about him.
Nice. I'll look him up for more of his work. What about you? What are your thoughts?
For the captains or this game I just created? Did I have
this game? No, you made this game. You have to play it too. I mean, that's just how this works.
Oh, fairness, you say. All right.
How dare you always be my own petard?
I will still say that one is a heart. But the heart is also fickle, so you'll have to take that for what you will.
Fair enough.
Two is just the leader. There's really no other way to put it for the character. From how the actress portrays her, from how everyone else interacts with her, there's like just this quality about her that automatically exudes leadership, and people kind of fall in line. Mm-hmm. Three is going to be, chaos isn't the right word. I like your what you've said actually sort of changes my opinion about three a little bit.
Oh, really?
Before that, it would have just been ruthlessness.
Right.
But I can see now the other aspects that you're talking about, especially in the later episodes. So it's a mix of ruthlessness and greed for me still. Like the realism part, I can sort of see it. But at the same time, I could also see three leaving everyone with all the money if that could have occurred earlier on.
Like, oh, no, totally.
I'm out.
It is a self-interested realism. I completely agree with you on that. But it also, to me, the greed does seem to stem from I need to keep myself safe. I need to keep the ship flying. You know, blah, blah, blah.
Four for me is still going to be the pragmatist. Because while four tries to keep to themselves more, at the end of the day, he knows that they need him to do X. And so he does X to make sure that Y doesn't happen to all of them and they die. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes like a grudging respect. Like even in the first, towards the second episode, the first one, when Six is going to try to fly the shuttle to blow themselves up, or acknowledges like that sacrifice and thing, I wish we'd had longer to like do these things together.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Five is simply the brains of the entire operation.
Okay.
I can see some of the different aspects of the heart, but it would be a mix of brains and naivety trying to figure out how the world operates, which goes back to being like a younger character and knowing you have like all this potential and trying to figure out how to apply that potential and not necessarily having suffered or gone through some of the same stuff as a crew around them has. Mm-hmm. And six is almost defined by their sense of duty and obligation. It's a duty to Five, to the crew, this sense of trying to do what is right. Mm-hmm. And that makes up that character, which leads into like a lot of other choices.
Okay. I can see glimmers of that. Now, as you pointed out, I could definitely see doing the right thing equating to duty. I can totally see that. So, okay.
I love doing the show with you just from like those vast, different lived experiences and seeing how everything is similar, but yet different at the same time.
Yeah, no, I really dig it. So the captains, I'll start with this. Cause I was thinking about it like as I was watching the show and I was like, crap, where am I going to rank two? So I was prepared for this and I still don't have an answer. So I'm not that prepared for it, but I do rank two pretty high. I think two is higher than Kirk. Let's start there. I think 2 is higher than Kirk because 2 would not take the risks that Kirk would take with her crew. That's been pretty clear to me in the episodes I've seen. She will take risks, but not with her crew, unless she absolutely has to. That's like the last choice for her. Kirk's a little more cavalier in that regard. I think I put her above, and this is me. I always mix up Sheridan and Sinclair because they have very similar names. Sinclair was the first captain of Bat 5, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I put her above Sinclair. I think it's still Sisko, Sheridan, and then 2. I think if 2 were in similar situations of Sisko and Sinclair, she might step up to that challenge. But her focus, she cares about the big picture, but only as it affects her family. Like, obviously, we have to take the galaxy because that's where my family lives, and I care about that. But a planet explodes, and she's like, well, that sucks. We're safe. So I think that she would struggle with abstract value. Like, this life inherently is valuable, or I need to kill these people I never met because that is what I need to do. I feel like she could do it, but I feel like that's not her instinct in the way that Sisko and Sheridan both have. So I'd probably put her pretty firmly in the middle. How about you?
Not to nearly mirror you in your assessment, but Kirk is still last on my totem pole of captains.
Mm-hmm.
Then there would be Sinclair. Kirk, because Kirk is really cavalier, cares more about himself than anyone else. And Sinclair, because Sinclair, while he's a decent captain, I don't think that he should be a captain.
Yeah.
And part of it is the character himself doesn't really think they should be a captain. So that influences how they interact and engage. So right. Kirk, Sinclair, then I would put 2. Because much like you're saying, 2 values like her immediate crew, and they're and won't risk them, but she'll constantly risk herself instead of them.
Right.
Which is admirable for a captain, but at the same time, she doesn't necessarily trust her crew to do what needs to get done.
Okay.
Then there's Sisko, who I think is like the exceptional captain. For me, Sisko and Sinclair, I kind of just want to make a one bar and have dual captains,
right.
But that would be cheating. Because Sisko is an exceptional captain who trusts his crew, gives them autonomy to do what they need to do, and then is willing to cover down for them if shit goes wrong. Mm-hmm. And then they have to come back and answer to him for what they did. So it's like handling it internally to make sure external forces don't mess with you. But then he also cares about the greater galaxy and at the same time is willing to take risk and do things that the other Star Trek captains aren't willing to do for the greater good.
Yeah.
And I think the reason Sheridan is still my number one, just barely, is that epic arc of a hero. But it boils down, actually, for Sheridan Sinclair, it boils down to this. Babylon 5 is more of a military show with politics compared to Star Trek that is more of an idealized military with politics.
Right.
And Sheridan, I would trust to make like these really hard decisions as a commander always and regardless of what happens.
Mm-hmm.
While Sisko, I think diplomacy is important. I feel that there'd be too much diplomacy when sometimes you need to take a little bit more action.
Okay. I could see that. I mean, I like we talked about last night, I would invert that for me personally. But I mean, yeah, again, we're talking about like fractions of percentage points difference, I think, really, at this point. I think we're both kind of solid that if we could put them both at the top, we would. But yeah.
So I promise going forward, at least for the next 2 minutes, since we won't be doing it for another couple of weeks, I will no longer give a disclaimer about Sisko and Sheridan.
we'll see how we hold to that. They're both interesting characters. We love them. But yeah, so just to kind of wrap up my thoughts on Dark Matter, it's definitely, it did for me what I hoped the show would do, which was give me access to new media I was not familiar with, as well as having new thoughts about media that I loved. And this was definitely firmly the camp of, I never would have watched this if it weren't for your recommendation. And I am super glad that I did. So
Glad to hear
Thank you for that.
Sure. Since we're wrapping up, Eddie, do you want to tell folks what they can expect next time?
Yes, next time we're going to talk about the 2000 reboot of Battlestar Galactica, which is a show that I have not watched since it was on the air. So it'll be fun to kind of revisit that. But the episodes we're going to watch are season one, episode 133, because we have to watch 33. 33 is the show that still stands out in my memory 20 years later. Season one, episodes 12 and 13, Kobol's Last Gleaming. And then the first episode of season two, which is Scattered. Much like Dark Matter, this is going to be heavily serialized. So I'm trying to keep to the first season-ish. We'll probably talk more about later spoilers, but this is one where learning what happens later seasons really does, I think, kind of impact your enjoyment of the show. So I want to keep to the kind of the initial conceits, talk about that a lot more. And then if we need to dive into the deeper lore, we can, but kind of keeping it to season one and a little bit of season two.
Awesome. So if folks want to follow on social media, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Pugstady, P-U-G-S-T-A-D-Y. You can also find me online at Pugstady.com. And you can also find me hanging out in the Darker Hue Discord.
If folks are looking for me, you can find me on Twitter at Darker_Hue. And in the Discord that I am going to be putting up a new tweet about, probably today or tomorrow, since the last link expired. If folks want to jump in, we'll talk about podcasts, we'll talk about works, we'll talk about anything, basically.
It's true.
Take care, folks.